I'm really excited about the opportunity to preach, and one of the things that whenever you get the chance to preach always strikes you is just how hard preaching is. Ross called me last Sunday and he said, look, if I can give you any help comparing all the relevant texts in Greek, reading all the secondary commentaries in every language, German, French, Italian, any help about the specific grammar, the opinion of scholars, I'd love to do that. I said, well, Ross, you know, it's just after church. I'm taking my nap. I haven't even really started. And he's like, don't worry. I usually don't have that stuff done until 2 o'clock the Sunday anyway. That way I can really use the week to prepare. So the amount of time and the amount of preparation that Ross puts into preaching is amazing. And I know people don't get the chance to hear from their own pulpit as often as they should, that what they're doing is important in the life of the church and incredible. So thank you, Ross. I've really enjoyed the series on the gifts, and I'd like to continue in the spirit of what Ross has been doing with a little bit of a different angle. Today I want to talk about what it means to see truth as a gift. And I'm a guy who likes to put my cards on the table early when I talk, so I'm going to put my cards on the table immediately. There are two things that motivate this for me. So the first motivation is based on what I have observed in our culture about how we think about the idea of a gift. In almost every culture, anthropologists have noted, the exchange of gifts plays a significant role. And in our culture, gifts are very important. I mean, you solemnize a marriage and the exchange of rings is a gift. You give gifts to the happy couple to show them your support. And if you want to know anything about the value of gifts, think about all the different ways that gifts reaffirm the bonds of love, of family, and of friendship. Think of the disaster that would ensue if you forgot to buy a birthday present for your child or your best friend, or, Lord forbid, an anniversary. Now, what is interesting to me, at least, is when you think about how central gift exchange is to our culture, you'd get the impression that gift exchanges are obligatory. Just think of what would happen if you went to your beloved and you said the following. Baby, I was going to get you a gift, but I don't think we should just give gifts out of obligation. I think we should give them as voluntary and as an expression of a spontaneous act of love, so I didn't get you something for Valentine's Day. But hopefully this will make future gifts more meaningful. Now, it's fun. Of course, I'd be on the couch for like 2 months. The point is, in our culture, we often think about gifts as something that has to be given instead of something that is not merited, as something that is an entitlement as opposed to something that is an act simply of love or overflowing. But we don't only connect with gifts with entitlement, we also connect gifts with possession. A gift is significant because it's mine. How many of you have a rule, for those of you who have children, for how long has to elapse before the second child can play with a birthday present? Right? A gift is significant because it is mine and it is no one else's. Now, if we think about gifts in terms of possession and entitlement, we're in danger of misunderstanding the nature of God's gifts. And we might even lose out on the kindness and the generosity that God shows us in giving them. So we shouldn't think about gifts as either entitlement or possession. But more importantly, when we think of our gifts as possessions, as given to us instead of something that is entrusted us by God, for the sake of the Christian community, we can often lose out on the ways that our gifts prepare us to do the work of the kingdom. Our gifts are not gifted to us as our possessions. Rather, our gifts are gifted to the whole body of Christ, and by extension, through us, but not for our sake, for the sake of that body. Now, sometimes the cultural logic of a gift as entitlement and a possession can cause us to miss the good we might do for Christian community. Sometimes it even causes us to limit the kinds of goods that we might do. The idea of a gift as my possession for my own good that only enables me to do certain kinds of work creates a relatively limiting understanding of the Christian life. Now, I have a relative who will remain nameless, except I'll say it is not Beth, who, when asked to clean up for Christmas dinner at the family, refused to participate with everyone else. So when pressed about it, why won't you help clean up? This relative said the following. There are two kinds of gifts, the gift of service and the gift of administration. I am gifted with the gift of administration, but not the gift of service. So to ask me to clean up would actually force me to use a gift that I do not have. Oh, there's a certain clever logic to it. I tried it at home the next day, and it didn't work very well. The point is that when you see a gift as an entitlement, as a possession, as something that is yours for your own sake, and simply given you for the sake of achieving tasks that are defined by you, you can miss out on the ways that God gives gifts in abundant and broad ways to service the whole community. Now, second big theme that's my motivation. It's the not-so-small matter of truth. Every year about this time of year, I have a bit of a life crisis. Now, for you, school starting may be great. For me, school starting is terrifying sometimes. And it's terrifying because I always have this specific moment in this specific class that I teach every year. I teach a class called Think, Speak, Argue. And the basis of the class is to teach first-year students at Carolina how to argue, and not argue like yell and get mad at each other, but rather how to make a reasoned argument and how to define what counts as a reasoned argument and what's not a well-reasoned argument. So we always hit this point in the semester where the students will say, what makes one argument better than another argument? And they actually have incredible resistance to the idea that you could say that one thing was better than another thing conceptually, which I think is weird for people who are paying for education, but whatever, we'll leave that aside. So I always force the issue. At this point in the conversation, I always force the issue and I say, look, I'm gonna poll the audience. I do this every year. How many of you are willing to say that truth is not simply a matter of perspective? And let's pick out a difficult truth. 6 million Jews, Christians, gypsies, and all kinds of other folks who were deemed to be undesirable by the Nazis were put to death in the Holocaust. How many of you are willing to say that that is objectively wrong? You would be shocked by the number of people who are unwilling to pony up on that. 65% of the students in my class this year were unwilling to say that the Holocaust was objectively wrong. 65% of the students in my class this year were willing to agree to disagree with a Nazi. You have your opinion, I have my opinion, let's just leave it at that. Our culture needs the gift of truth. If people can't even make the most elementary moral calculations that cause them to say that was self-evidently one of the worst things that happened in history is abhorrent, that we ought to reject at our core, if we don't have the basic understanding of truth that allows us to say that, we're in trouble. So I want to talk about the idea of the gift of truth. The passage I've selected today is from Acts 17. And it's one that I reflect on often. And I want to work through this sermon to basically talk about three ways that the Bible helps us conceive of how people approach the question of truth. So I want to talk about three models of truth that the Bible talks about. Not advocates, but talks about. Two of them it talks about, one of them that it advocates. So the three models I'm going to walk through are truth is a matter of indifference, truth is the possession of a specific group, and finally, that truth is a gift that sets us free, and the nature of that gift obligates us to share it. Truth is a matter of indifference. Truth is a sole possession of one group. Truth is a gift that we are given and that we ought to give to others that sets us free. Truth is a matter of indifference. Now, imagine you're an up-and-comer in the political scene in Imperial Rome. If you play your cards right, you can get a sweet assignment and live out the rest of your career in some luxurious estate kissed by the Mediterranean sun. And your career is going pretty good till you get assigned to this backwater called Judea. Province is unruly, you probably miss the pleasantries of Roman life. Your main goal is just to keep the crowds happy, collect taxes from the locals, and get out of there. Now, this is the position that Pontius Pilate finds himself in when he's confronted with the choice to send Jesus to the cross. The Sanhedrin had brought Jesus before Pilate on trumped-up charges, probably the charge that he argued against the obligation to pay taxes to Rome, although it's not clear from the text that this is the charge. And it was likely the charge because this was a capital offense. So the story in John 18 goes like this, starting in verse 29. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" Now it should be clear to Pilate that something is wrong at this point, because the way the members of the Sanhedrin respond is basically nonsense. They say, "Well, if he were not a criminal, we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate's no dummy. So he senses that there's something going on here, and as any good bureaucrat does, he first attempts to pass the problem off to someone else. Let me escalate that to a higher level of service. Pilate says, take him yourselves and judge him by your own law. The Jews say, we have no right to execute anyone. So Pilate decides to do a little inquiry. This is what he does. These are verses 33 through, 37. Pilate went back inside the palace and summoned Jesus and asked him, are you the king of the Jews? Is that your own idea, Jesus asked, or did others talk to you about me? Am I a Jew, Pilate replied. It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What is it that you have done? Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest. But now my kingdom is from another place. You are a king then, says Pilate. Jesus answered, you are right in saying that I am a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this reason I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. Now, here's the kicker. Pilate does not deny that what Jesus is saying is true. He has no reason to. There's no textual evidence that he disbelieves any of this. He instead answers Jesus' claim to be on the side of truth by simply saying, quod est veritas. What is truth, after all? And with that, he goes out to the crowd. He declares that he finds Jesus guilty of nothing, but he turns him over to be crucified anyway. Truth, for Pilate, is a matter of indifference. He does not deny that what Jesus is saying is the truth. If we take him at his word, we actually believe that the truth of the matter is that Jesus has done nothing wrong under Roman law. There isn't even textual evidence that Pilate doesn't see the kingdom to come. So why does he release him to be crucified? Because Pilate is indifferent to the truth, he lets his obligation to the truth be overwhelmed by other concerns. The concern to keep peace with the local population. That sweet job in Rome he'd like someday. To not make a stir. To make the easy to go through a difficult situation in a way where there's an easy outcome, even with impassioned viewpoints on all sides. Shameful, isn't it? Shameful. Well, it's easy for us to look at Pilate and think, how shameful. But here's the question for us. How often do you pull a Pilate? If you were honest with yourself, how many times have you been in a situation where the very nature of the truth was at stake, and you decided not to press the issue because it might offend someone? How many times have you, like Pilate, been confronted with a situation that demanded the very face of Jesus, that you bring the word of truth, and have you chosen to take the path that least rocked the boat? Now, I get it. There are 1,000 different reasons when you're called to give an account of what you believe that it's easier to back off. We don't want to appear too preachy. There are things we can't talk about in the workplace. The time wasn't right, you don't have the words, but here's the thing. It's easy for us to sit in here and criticize the freshmen in my class for their position on the Holocaust. It's easy for us to blame Pilate for washing his hands of Jesus' fate, but we essentially do the same thing when, all the time, in the name of social conventions, we act as if we were indifferent to the truth, even if inside we feel that we are burning with it. Perhaps the biggest failing of the church is that though we can sit with such sincerity in here and say how important the Word of God is to us, for all intents and purposes, when given the opportunity to do what should be the simplest thing, to proclaim the birth, death, and resurrection of Jesus, we defer. And for what reason? Because it will make the world hate you? God says that is a blessing. Because you don't have the words? God has promised to give them to you, Luke 21. They will persecute you and you'll be brought before kings and governors for my sake. This will be your opportunity to bear witness. Settle it therefore in your minds not to meditate beforehand how to answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which none of your adversaries will be able to withstand. You see, when we stop acting as if we are indifferent to the truth, the point is that God grants us two gifts. One, we are given the gift of being able to bear witness. Note that Jesus calls this an opportunity. Oftentimes we think settings where we are called upon to bear witness as challenges, as impositions, as occasions for anxiety or for fear. Jesus says these things are a gift. They are a moment where we can share the life-changing and redemptive power of the truth. And with the gift of the situation comes a second gift, the gift of the right words, of the wisdom that your adversaries cannot contradict. So what is our real concern? Why don't we share more? I think that so often we are motivated by what is a very understandable concern. We want to be good, respectful, tolerant members of the modern world. We don't share because we don't want to offend. And I'll tell you, especially with some of the places I've been, it's easy to find lots of examples of drive-by evangelism. You know the type, the person who's quick to hand out a tract and a little quicker to condemn. There's a second model for us to think about truth that we need to counterpose against the first, against the idea of truth as indifference. Model two, truth is an exclusive possession. Consider the 8th chapter of John. A group of Pharisees bring a woman who had been caught committing adultery to Jesus, and they wanted to stone her. So Jesus utters the famous line, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." And he stands up to the Pharisees, and one by one they leave until Jesus is left standing alone with the woman, and he says, "Go and sin no more." Now the Pharisees aren't going to take that kind of public affront lightly, so they come back to him. And they say, "Basically, you've broken the law. You've let an adulterer go." Now, Jesus' response is pretty interesting. Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." So the Pharisees said, "You are bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true." Jesus answered, "Even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true, for I know where I came from and where I'm going. And you don't know where I come from or where I'm going. You judge according to the flesh. I judge according to no one. Yet even if I do judge, my judgment is true, for it is not I alone who judge, but the Father who sent me." Now, here Jesus is manipulating a very interesting element in Judaic law, and he's using it against the Pharisees. In the law, the testimony of one person was suspect. You're testifying about yourself is the accusation. But the testimony of two people was to be trusted. Jesus is arguing that by its nature, his testimony is the testimony of two. By his nature, his testimony is both his testimony and the testimony of the Father who sent him. Now, this is an affront to the Pharisees, who believed that the truth of God was their sole and exclusive inheritance as a result of some promise given to Abraham way back when. Now, the reference to Abraham is telling here. If there is one thing that marked the religious sensibilities of the Pharisees, it was that they were God's chosen people. That the sanction provided by the Abrahamic promise, they were the possessors of religious truth. Thus, what we have in this story in John is a classic example of Jesus' confrontation with the religious authorities of the time. Even though his actions fulfilled the spirit of mercy and therefore were the perfection of the law, the Pharisees believed that he had violated a truth that was their sole possession. The idea that the truth is the province of one group, whether it be a people, a religious authority, scholarly opinion, or what I think is often the most insidious form of truth as the possession of a group, common sense, well, everybody knows it, is dangerous. And why? Because the idea that truth is a possession, an exclusive possession, slips ever so subtly from the idea that a group says something because it is the truth, to because a group says something, it is the truth. Instead of a testimony to the truth, it is the truth by nature of the privileged group saying it. The contemporary churches, perhaps more than any other body, are guilty of this sin many times in thinking that the truth is our sole possession. And two things happen when one treats the truth as an exclusive possession. One is internal to the church, and one is external to it. One, we get hung up on thinking that everything that we believe has the status of inviolable truth, so we miss out on the essential truths that unite us to our Christian brothers and sisters despite our differences. I cannot tell you how many of my Baptist friends at Liberty were concerned about my salvation because I was a Lutheran, and we actually drank wine in church, and we did not read the red letter Bible. But more important of the idea of unity in Christian essentials, of the idea that Christ is the core of all we believe, the idea that the truth is the sole possession of the church has damaged our witness towards secular culture. It has led the church to be self-righteous and judgmental in matters of politics. It has made many Christians fundamentally suspicious of science. And more importantly, it has inflected the message that we would like to convey with a tone that hardens the ears of our unchurched friends. We would like to say, "Jesus loves you. You are so valuable that he died for you and he can make you whole." But what our tone conveys is a basic disagreement with lifestyle choices. A little squabble over personal politics. Am I suggesting here that the church is not the bearer of truth? No, by no means. I am suggesting that instead of seeing truth as a matter of indifference or as a possession to be guarded, that we should see truth as a gift which is given to us that we ought to share with the world. Three, truth is a gift. What are the qualities of a gift? A gift should strike you with humility. You did nothing to deserve it. A gift should strike you with thankfulness. It comes from somewhere else. It may even be unexpected. And a gift, because it is something that should strike us with humility and thankfulness, it is something we should want to pass on. Think about Paul in Athens as a model embodying this understanding of truth. The 17th chapter of Acts tells us that Paul was anything but indifferent about what was going on in Athens. The text says the spirit was provoked within him, but the Greek is much stronger than that. The Greek word is paroxuento, which is the same root word that we have for paroxysm, to have an attack, a sudden attack of a disease or symptom to be seized up. Paul has a sudden or violent attack of emotion. He's overwhelmed by the idolatry that he sees. But what does this cause him to do? He does not scream, nor does he pick up a sign that declares that Athens will burn. No, he goes to reason with the Athenians. He's not interested in staying in the narrow confines of the home church that he must have been staying at, nor does he content himself with gathering like-minded Christians over tea and talking about the moral decay of Greek society. Instead, he goes to the synagogues and the marketplaces, and he lays his beliefs on the line. He even goes to the Areopagus with a bunch of Greek philosophers. And what was that? It was the most public space in the entire city. It was the place where justice was dispensed. It was the place adjacent to the marketplace where people would gather to talk. It's kind of like the mall and the coffee house and town hall all rolled into one. And Paul thinks to make his case, he needs to take it to the very heart of the city. And standing there, he says, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are religious. I was walking around and I found an altar that had an inscription to the unknown God. What you worship is unknown, I will proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being the Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands. He made one from one man, every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries in their dwelling place that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far off from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. Even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring." Now take a minute to think about the structure of Paul's argument. If you want a master course on how to treat the truth of the gospel as more than a matter of indifference, as more than the parochial possession of a few, consider Paul's example. I'll close by saying there are three things to notice about this and three things that you can apply to your life. To notice, one, a gift should be given with grace. If Paul was a drive-by evangelizer, he could have said, "My God condemns your unknown God." But he doesn't do that. He begins the act of witnessing by noting that there were already things in the Athenian belief structure that reveal the truth of God. Because if we really believe that God is the reason, the purpose, and cause for the being of the entire universe, then it's written into the very code of existence. And Paul witnesses that way. He's internalized the realization of Colossians 4:6, that speech that reflects Christ is always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that it answers everyone. Paul's witness, ironically, from our normal model, starts by giving credibility to the beliefs of the folks of Athens, and then moves on to talk about how the gift of the truth of Christ completes the truths that they already have, if only provisionally. So the model of a gift is a gift given with grace. Second, the gift of the truth makes other things make sense. One way of saying this is to say that so often in Christian culture, when we talk about truth, we often think about truth as a battle. We think about it in the metaphor of the culture war. We think about truth as constantly being under assault. The gift of truth needs no defense. It is already there waiting to be uncovered. It simply needs to be declared. This is why John is constantly referring to Jesus as the Logos, which means word, but which also means truth and ordering principle. If we are to believe the testimony of the Bible, the truth of Jesus is already built into the structure of reality. Now, that's why I have to laugh every time some joker says that Christianity is suspect because it incorporates elements of other belief structures. I hear this from my colleagues all the time. The most common academic critique of Christianity. It's stolen from pagans. Christian is really an Egyptian sun rite. Everything that you people believe is prefigured in some other religious system. Maybe. If you take seriously the claim that Christ is the very logos of the universe, the model for truth, the way in which everything has its being, then any system which incompletely prefigures Christianity testifies to what will be the ultimate truth of its completion. The other people are the shallow imitators. We have the real deal. This is the model of Christian truth that's declared in the Bible. Truth is the truth of Christ is the central fact of history. Everything else is just a narrow imitation. Our goal is to declare it. Paul's mode of witnessing, therefore, is not to say, not to deny the resources that are already in other religious systems. His mode of witnessing is not to tear down the Athenians' beliefs. Rather, it is to show them how what they believe already anticipates and is completed by the ultimate truth of Christ. A gift completes other things and makes other things make more sense. Three, a gift is personal. It's not in the sense that you own it, but in the sense that it should be tailored towards the needs of its recipient. And this is especially the case with the gift of truth. You see, if you're a Christian, like it or not, we believe something wacky about the nature of the truth. We do. The classic philosophical definition of truth is that truth is a quality of a proposition where a statement matches with reality. If I say the sky is blue, that statement is true if and only if the objective conditions of that statement match with the reality outside. Now, here's the crazy thing. Christians do not believe that truth is a proposition. We believe the truth is a person. And a person is different from a proposition. As Christians, we do not believe that truth is a quality of a proposition. My favorite theologian, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, put it this way. When we want to know Christ, we could ask questions that start out with what or how. What does it mean to say that God exists? How can you know? How can there be a God if there is evil in the world? What makes you think you are right? How can you know? What Bonhoeffer said that I think is just brilliant is that you can't know God if you start with a question of what or how. You can only know God if you start with a who. Who is God as revealed in the person of Jesus Christ? If you don't start there, you'll miss the boat. Jesus will often say in the course of the gospel, 30-something times, I think, I am telling you the truth, that. But the most revolutionary thing that he claims is not that he says or knows the truth, it's that he is the truth, that he is the truth of God reconciling himself to the world. And what does this mean for the gift of truth? It means that for others to know this truth, we must start, we must proceed, and we must finish with the who that is the truth, that speaks to each individual in their uniqueness, that offers them the gift of salvation. Paul does not focus on the what's of the people of Athens, what they did not know, how they were wrong. He simply invites them to meet a who, the person of Jesus Christ. So, application. Three things, and they're quick. One, don't be stingy about your gift. So often when we think about witnessing as scary, or in deferring it, we argue we are being polite. And when we do this, we're ascribing ourselves an admirable motivation. Either I was afraid so I didn't do it, or I was trying to be polite. If you think about truth as a gift, then you need to recontextualize what it means to think about witnessing in that way, because really what you're doing is you're being stingy. You've been given an incredible gift. It should strike you with humility and thankfulness and cause you to share it with others. Don't be stingy with your gift. Two, be generous in the telling. Notice that when Paul speaks to the Athenians, he makes every effort to talk to them directly in their vocabulary, using their own idioms, and to speak it in a way that doesn't fundamentally trouble at the beginning the way that they think about the world. He takes a few of their categories and he uses them to illuminate the gospel. This is what it means to be generous in the telling. Tell in such a way that your telling of the story meets with where folks already are so that it can be best received. And three, dialogue, not diatribe. The most admirable thing about Paul for me is that he lays his beliefs on the line. Dialogue considers the response of the audience and responds to it. Diatribe is indifferent towards the audience. So my advice, be open, be frank, be willing to voice doubt, do all the things that you do in any other dialogue when witnessing or sharing, but do so in faith of the power of the good word, of the gift of truth, given us by Christ. Amen.